listening to Tech Talk Radio, proudly sponsored by D-Link, building networks for people.
I don't think anyone should think this is a license to continue to breach copyright. iiNet is not responsible for stopping it.
There's no real demand for censorship of the internet in Australia. There's no other country in the Western world, at least, that's trying anything like this.
Netflix aren't better at anything, but we think we've got something, and we call it the iPad.
And today, we're delighted to be present at the creation of digital radio in Australia.
Senator Conroy is completely botching the implementation of this filtering policy of his.
For adults who want to be able to watch the other material, we're not proposing to do that.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
I'm Andrew McComb, and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio, proudly brought to you by D-Link. The dust has barely settled on the AFACT versus iiNet copyright case when newsit.co.uk reported this week that the UK government plans to force ISPs to crack down on copyright abuse. The ambitious plan will cost the industry anywhere between £250 and £500 million. That's around $830 million, according to an estimate published by the Department for Business. A report tabled in the UK Parliament said file sharing of audio, video and data, or anything in the digital format between users on a computer network, has increased significantly in the past few years, which has served to reduce the incentive for the creative industries to invest in the development, production and distribution of new innovative content. The report went on to say that the UK government's intention is to make it easier for rights holders to bring targeted civil action against suspected copyright infringers and place obligations on ISPs when informed by rights holders to notify subscribers of their unlawful behaviour, and to maintain records of the most frequent offenders to allow rights holders to take targeted legal action, something not that dissimilar from what AFACT were after. It's worth noting that what Australians can do legally when making copies of media for personal use most likely differs from what UK citizens can do, as copyright laws are legislated by the respective countries' parliaments. But it's safe to say that the protection of copyright owners' rights is paramount in both. The difference here is that the UK Parliament is opening up a path to the consumer, which is what hasn't happened here, but may. Australian Federal Court Judge Justice Cowdroy found that ISPs cannot be held responsible for what their customers do on their network, which is subject to appeal in the High Court of Australia soon. It seems that the powers that be in the UK have skipped this phase and opened up the possibilities of mandatory reporting to copyright holders of what people are downloading through British ISPs. Both the Australian and British governments head off to the polls this year, and both have internet issues to take to the voters. One thing's for sure, both governments are putting citizens' privacy to the test.
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
Adam Turner compares CDs to downloads. Telstra opens up the door to LTE mobile communications. Google set to leave China next month. iiNet seeks clarification in the High Court. And IE9 is not compatible with Windows XP. First up, though, here's Dr. Ron with the latest from the Tech Talk News Desk.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, Stephen Conroy delays the net filter legislation in Parliament. Fresh signs that Google will be ceasing operations in China. Apple's plan for failing iPad batteries. Telstra announces PSTN video calling in the face of diminishing landline revenues. And the FBI uses Facebook to fight crime. Welcome to Tech Talk News. Senator for Broadband, Communications and the Digital Economy, the Honourable Stephen Conroy, has failed to introduce his controversial net filter legislation into Parliament. The Parliament adjourned last week until May, with the autumn sittings now closed. Although the government had promised that the proposed net filter legislation would be introduced in the autumn sittings, no official statement or explanation was forthcoming from the Minister's office. Queensland Liberal Senator Sue Boyce asked Senator Conroy in Parliament last week if he was concerned that a recent report by Reporters Without Borders now ranked Australia alongside China on an under-surveillance watch list. Senator Conroy said he was not concerned by Australia's addition to the watch list and launched an angry attack against opponents of the proposed legislation, Electronic Frontiers Australia, and the ABC's Hungry Beast program.
Electronic Frontiers have run one of the most disgraceful misinformation campaigns, have misled Australians. But if you want further evidence of why this is not getting mainstream debate, Let me take you to the Hungry Beast ABC show just recently. A show that advocates against our policy.
On its open internet website, the EFA said in response to the Senator's comments that they believe the decision to delay the introduction of the filtering legislation, coupled with Senator Conroy's unprovoked attacks, as demonstrating that the government is on the back foot and beginning to feel the pressure of the open internet movement. The EFA believes that the net filter legislation has now been delayed until Parliament sits again in June or August. Search engine juggernaut Google last week missed a deadline to re-register as an Internet Content Provider, or ICP, in China. The ICP license is required by the Chinese government for companies operating websites inside the country and has to be renewed annually before the end of March. While industry observers have said it's a sign that Google is preparing to shut down its search engine in China, a Google spokesman in the United Kingdom said it's a bit early for such speculation. Google also last week confirmed that a group of 27 Chinese advertising agencies had asked to discuss possible compensation for business losses if the company shuts down the Google.cn search engine. Chinese media said last week that Google had sent a notice to clients saying the company would cease its operations in China at the end of March. However, Google declined to comment on the report. These latest developments have emerged since Google announced earlier this year that negotiations with the Chinese government over the censoring of search results had come to a standstill. The New York Times last week reported that China's government has warned major partners of Google's China-based search engine that they must comply with censorship laws even if Google does not. The Chinese government last week said that Google's plan to end censorship was irresponsible. Apple has announced a plan for owners of its new tablet, the iPad, in case of failing batteries. Apple says it will replace the entire iPad for about $100 plus $7 in shipping. The iPhone and iPad have both been criticized for having sealed-in batteries that can't be accessed or replaced by the device's owners. Apple says it will give people a brand new unit whose iPads have a diminished ability to hold an electrical charge. The information was posted on Apple's support website and was reported last week by popular blog site Apple Insider. The first iPads go on sale in late April, starting at $499. According to the Wall Street Journal, hundreds of thousands of iPads have already been sold since the device went on pre-sale on the 12th of March. Telstra and Polycom have announced the introduction of face-to-face video calling using desktop telephones. A Telstra spokeswoman, Ms. Carol White, said that more than 300 organisations using Telstra's hosted IP telephony product, TIPT, could take advantage of the high-quality business-to-business video telephony service simply by upgrading their desktop phones. Analysts have said the new service is being positioned as an answer to businesses' needs for reduced carbon emissions and travel costs, as well as increasing FaceTime with customers. Telstra's effort in promoting landline services is sorely needed after revenue from the public switch telephone network declined $222 million year-on-year during the 31st of December half-year, and revenue from ISDN services declined $20 million. And any criminals dumb enough to brag about their exploits on social networking sites have now been warned the next Facebook friend who contacts you may be an FBI agent. The UK's Guardian last week said that US federal law enforcement agents have been using social networking sites, including Facebook, LinkedIn, MySpace and Twitter, to search for evidence and witnesses in criminal cases, and in some cases, they've even used the networks to track suspects. The FBI's activities were revealed in a Justice Department document obtained by a legal advocacy group in San Francisco. But a former US cybersecurity prosecutor said that while federal investigators should be able to go undercover online, just like in the real world, rules needed to be developed so that law enforcement agencies didn't intrude on personal relationships. I'm Dr. Ron, and that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
The Do Not Call Register is about to expire.
Oh, did you re-register?
Oh. I
did.
No, I haven't yet.
Has your date of birth changed? That sort of stuff.
It sort of really wasn't a good time in Sony's history, was it?
That seems a bit short-sighted of them, Graham.
It's not as dumb as having no keyboard at all and having to balance it on your knee with Velcro while you type on the virtual keyboard on the screen.
Yeah. It comprises augmented reality to navigate.
Argumentative reality.
I have that on my phone. Don't you worry about that.
Have you seen them?
I've seen the YouTube videos, yeah.
Some of these older technologies, like email and like the DNS, didn't quite have the security that they needed.
Wow. Is all I can say on that one? Wow.
Yeah, it's a bit of a challenge, perhaps, to the commercial operators to do the same thing.
Perhaps there's a good tech show they might like to take.
Absolutely. Yeah,
but if they can't find a good tech show, then refer them to us.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. Hello, everybody. I'm Andrew McComb. Across from me are the regulars, Justin Dunlop, Dr. Ron, and Graeme Callaghan, plugging things in furiously into things underneath the bench there at the moment, so we can hopefully get Sydney on the line. But anyway, we'll come to that later. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show. How's it been?
You'd think we'd have this organised by now, wouldn't you? I've been doing it for 4 or 5 years or something.
Oh, is that long?
Yeah.
There you go. No, yeah, you'd think we'd have it all tied and nice and tight and bundled, but, you know, we set up a TV studio every time we come in here with these webcam-y things and stuff like that.
Well, we do a bit of... we do some additions and some changes and things just to get everything working in here how we like it, don't we? And we've only got a very, very short time frame in which to do that, because we have the previous program that's outgoing, and then we come in and we've got... As long as it takes me to read the news and you to do your spiel.
Yeah, ventriloquism. It's a wonderful thing.
We build a radio station from the ground up in that time, don't we?
Absolutely. Well, yes. Not so much. The radio station's already built. We just, by the time we get things to record and plug in and stuff like that, yes, good like that. Anyway, how's the week been? I've had a wonderful week. I've got a new toy.
Oh, what have you got?
Oh, sorry, JD, I'll turn you up. I've bought a lovely new Hewlett-Packard Z400 workstation, which is a dual-core i7 device with hyper-threading. And boy, does it kick some grunt. Oh, it's good stuff. Just sort of giving it a run for its money at the moment. And what used to take on some of the old machines, you know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes to render out, it takes a few moments on this little baby. She
and
goes.
Only, and only dual-core, not quad-core? Or
i7 should be quad-core,
yeah, no, it'd
be
quad-core. Yeah. You're right, actually. Yeah. They're great. Yes, it's quad-core. It's got four things when you do Control-Alt-Delete and look at the pictures.
That's very impressive.
That'd be quad-core without hyper-threading.
Yeah, but this is hype. This has got hyper-threading.
In which case, you should see eight.
Eight cores, yes.
Oh, well, there you go. So you learned something on this show. Excellent. Well, I got four, but apparently it's hyper-threading, which is half the... Maybe I've got to finish building it, probably.
We're getting very technical already. If this is the...
That's my new toy.
Moving this on. Is the direction the tonight's program's headed, it's...
Yeah, moving right along then, shall we? That's my new toy. I just had to brag.
What are you going to be doing with that new toy? Because that sounds like a very, very high-end...
Oh, just the normal stuff.
Fancy computer.
Make some telly that people like to watch on their telly.
TV programs.
Yeah, TV programs. It's what we do for crust.
So this is not a computer just for reading emails and looking at the odd website?
No.
It's a computer for making TV programs or playing World of Warcraft.
Just think how many emails you could send on it, though.
Yeah, spammers could just pump them out at a ferocious rate, couldn't they? Anyway.
Sure they do.
Enough of that. Anyone? Yes. Coro? Dr. Ron, should we go to the Coro bit?
Plenty of correspondence. Hello to our new radio station, the Greater Hume Shire Community Radio, 2GHR.
Are they back for more?
They are on 96.5. And we're all in the chat room tonight, which is at chat.techtalkradio.com.au. And Trent is in there, so welcome, Trent. And everybody else, come and join us there. We've got Scruffy Buzzer. We've got Warlock there, of course. Hi, Warlock. Jono. We've got Radio Gold Wee War, I think, is there joining us as well. We've got Spawn Camper, all sorts of people. So come and say hello in the chat room. If you're not listening live, you can have a look at the show notes at forum.techtalkradio.com.au. Andrew, you said Goulburn last week. It's not Goulburn. Don't say Goulburn.
Didn't I say that?
Yeah, don't say Goulburn.
Where is it?
Goulburn.
No, not Goulburn.
It's 2GHR, the Greater Hume Shire.
Cessnock.
Cessnock. It's up north. It's
you told me Goulburn.
No, I didn't. Oh. I would never have told you that.
Right, I'll meet you outside afterwards.
All right.
We'll sort this
right
out.
Right, it's on. Hello to new forum members, Peter H. And I think it's Jammin, J-A-M-I-N, have all joined the forum in recent times. Jammin's got a very interesting thread running on the forum at the moment. He says, love the podcast. Maybe you guys can give me some advice on this. Oh, it gets very technical very quickly. I recently built myself a VMware ESX box.
What's going on with VMware?
I don't know.
The way, there was something in the news tonight I looked at about licensing and Microsoft and how they're giving it away or something like that. I'm not up with VMware, so I'm not really sure, but I just thought maybe someone else might be across it.
Well, he says, I've gone crazy creating some web servers and other things just because I can. The problem is accessing these. Yeah. The problem is accessing these over the internet as they all sit NATed, which I think means network address translation, behind my router at home. I've registered a domain, .com.au domain. I can run one web server by doing port forwarding. He wants to know how to access other machines behind his firewall. So there's some people that have actually put some very sensible responses there in the forum. So you can have a look at Jammin's post there.
And his question's pretty interesting because I actually went to reply to him and then realized what his question was, and it's not all that straightforward. So it's pretty easy to have multiple websites with different domain names on one server.
Shared hosting. Correct. The big guys do it, yep.
And My Machine at Home, in fact, does it for three or four private accounts. But what he's wanting to do is to actually share across a range of computers inside the network address translated router. So that's somewhat more difficult. And one of the suggestions there is about using port forwarding and different ports, so...
Once you get it up and running, it'll be fine. You'll go, gee, that was easy. Mm. It's getting to that point.
It's finding the answer.
That's the joys of technology. It's getting to that point where it does what you want it to do. That's the challenge, really, isn't it?
If our new listeners on 2GHR are listening to this and thinking, no, this show's way too technical for us. No, that's more than as technical as we get, so don't worry. We're not going to get bogged down in those sorts of things. But if you want to have a look at what people are suggesting, go to forum.techtalkradio.com.au. Mark Diggins, former panelist and now US correspondent, Mark, says... Now, I was talking about FreeCycle a couple of episodes ago. I think it was a website that Warlock suggested.
Yes, we like FreeCycle.
Mark says, listening to the Tech Talk Radio podcast, I used FreeCycle to furnish half the house. Mark. Thanks,
come
Mark.
Come to that, hasn't Mark?
He really likes FreeCycle.
Absolutely.
So come to that. GD says, hi, guys. Now, GD is in the forum, in the chat room tonight. He's mod. Hi, GD. Guys, with you, Andrew... jetting off to the USA, it would be great, before you go, if you could talk about the technology you're going to take with you.
That's a good point, isn't it?
I know you're taking a shiny new netbook, GD he is.
Yes, yes.
He's using it tonight, actually. What about batteries? How do you charge them? Do you have to buy a charger especially for use in the US?
No.
Or is there an adapter available?
You go to your local hardware shop and look in the television antenna section, you'll see them there for about $3. It basically just changes the Australian power plug, which is diagonal, to the vertical plug for the US system. But
now,
most...
it's worth mentioning that you need to read the power pack that came with your device before you do that to make sure that it will accept 110 volts instead of 240.
Yes, that's a very good point.
A lot of them do. If you read the power pack, it says input voltage 110 to 240.
Yes, correct. And after you've done that, you'll find that it'll work. Like, even the gear at work that I buy, like videotape machines and all that these days, work from anywhere from 100 volts to 250 volts.
Yeah, they automatically select.
They just switch, which is just fantastic. So it makes life really easy when you travel these days with technological type bits of gear, especially the modern stuff, the new stuff that you buy just now. You can just simply plug it into 110 volts over there with an adapter and away you go.
And of course, with Apple, you can spend the premium amount and buy a adapter for your MacBook or...
Well, you can buy an
iPod.
A $300 adapter worth $10.
Yeah. No, it's just, it's the nice rounded white look that they've got on their power supplies where you can take out the little, they call it a duck head.
So a what?
A duck head. So you can take out
the
pins.
Oh, yeah, so the white funny, sorry.
And then you slide in the new set of pins for Europe or America or whatever, and away you go. About $5 a throw on eBay usually.
How have you got your phone set up so calls don't cost an arm and a leg?
Oh, that's simple.
Is it?
I have a 605 number.
I think, in brackets, I think I remember you were getting a US phone sent over.
I have.
Brackets. And your camera, are you taking one or using the camera in the phone? Now, Andrew won't use a camera in a phone.
No. I've got a new little device. I'll be taking a bit of HD video when I'm at Google. If I'm allowed to, I'll be taking some snaps in around Google. So watch the...
HD video? What are you using to shoot that?
It's a video camera which records... It's a Sony device. It's an HC9... So I can't remember the exact
model
number.
That sounds big.
No. Handycam.
Right.
Handycam does good, nice stills. But in answer, just going back a bit, traveling overseas, if you can, get a SIM card in the local market. It's the only way to travel.
For your mobile phone.
And if you want, the one I'm getting is, and I guess this isn't advertising because basically AT&T don't actually work in this country.
But some would argue that it doesn't work in their country.
Yeah, but. Well, I'll let you know when I'm over there. You can grab a SIM in the local market. In traveling to the US, I chose AT&T because I'm going to try the iPhone in the market over there and see if it's just as bad over here as it is over there. It'll cost you – they have great plans over there. For example, you can have a $3 a day plan, which means you've got – like you buy postpaid here in Australia – you can buy and charge up your phone card or your mobile phone. But rather than charge on a per-call basis on a cap like you get over here, the AT&T, I think they call it pay-as-you-go type sort of plan over there, they charge you one flat fee for a day. So you can use your phone as often as you like, ring anyone internally in within the United States relatively cheaply. In fact, it's part of a $3 a day cap. So you just go for gold on your phone, $3 a day. And if you don't use it on a day, like a Saturday or a Sunday, you it's don't gone. Pay $3, which is a really good thing to do. And then, of course, if you're calling a US number, that's it's just as cheap these days as calling you just sitting in across the room here on my mobile phone. So it's not really an issue for people calling me in the United States. So, yeah, it's a 605 number.
I think I mentioned when I went overseas in 2008. Yeah, I regret not doing that. Should have done that. Should have got a SIM card locally and dropped it into my phone. GD says, the reason for these questions is that I'm going to the USA for the first time in September. Unfortunately, my journey won't be as interesting as NAB. I'm only going to the Kennedy Space Center to see the Discovery Shuttle launch.
What do you mean? I'd rather do that.
But hey, someone's got to do it. I think he's being a bit facetious there. Gee, that's fantastic. Very, very envious that you're going to do that sort of trip. That's great.
It'll be one of the very last shuttle flights too. I think we've got four more to go.
Something like that. Then they could retire.
Didn't Barack Obama can the US budget on space travel in the short term?
Well, he changed all the priorities around.
Since the GFC?
And they're not going to go. They were going to go back to the moon, and now they're not.
Now they're going to have a health system instead.
I'm not sure that that's definitely related.
Oh, okay.
I must admit, I don't understand this health system debate in the United States. It seems to me that the world's richest country, if you're sick, you should be able to get help. But
You'll be able to now, but
that's beside the point. Yes,
space shuttles.
They've canned the bit with going back to the moon, but they've extended the life of the International Space Station.
Are they going to Mars? Have they decided about that?
Well, maybe. They've pushed that back a little bit further into the future.
Because that was one of the points of the space station, wasn't it? To have an orbiting...
Yeah, and they've extended the life of the space station, which is a good idea because they're only just finishing it now. And, they'll have a look at some different priorities. And NASA's going to get out of the sort of the routine space business, from what I can gather of, you know, satellite launching and that sort of stuff, and leave that to private enterprise and start getting into some basic research and some pushing the envelope stuff and perhaps ultimately heading to Mars, as you say, or heading to some nearby asteroids.
Isn't Richard Branson taking over NASA?
No, Richard Branson is not taking over NASA.
I thought he was doing, you could spend $250,000 and buy a ticket on the first Richard.
No, but that's what I mean. NASA are going to get out of that routine, just launching vehicles.
That's what I meant. They're going to hand it over to Richard Branson to do.
No. Richard Branson is going to run a separate private company that isn't NASA.
Oh, it's Virgin Space.
That's going to do that. And NASA are going to do something else. Richard Branson is not taking over NASA.
Okay. Good. I'm glad we clarified that. Lifetime. So yeah, to go and see a shuttle launch in Florida would be pretty cool.
That would be quite something to see.
So GD, make sure you spend a little bit of money, get a really nice video camera,
and then come and see us with the tape afterwards.
Yeah. A Sony 800 on XD be really good with a nice lens. You'll do really well.
Andrew, I'll send you a link.
Anyway, that's good.
And a form where you can put your Visa card number.
Yes.
He'll look after you. Yeah.
Has anyone seen the Hubble 3D? It's showing at IMAX at the moment. No. Anyone seen that? Because I reckon that'd be worth a look-see. I haven't seen it either. It was just a general question. But IMAX in space would have to look pretty awesome, I would imagine, on a very big screen in one of those big cinemas. So, all right. So there you go. That's the perils of traveling to foreign countries, I guess, from a technological point of view. Admittedly, the US is pretty good. Voltage-wise, as you say, take a good adapter. Read the power plug or the power adapter on your device.
Yes, don't plug your 240 device in unless it can actually work with 110 volts, because then you might have bad things happening.
It's worse when you go the other way, believe me.
Well, it could be equally bad either way, to be honest. But yes, it could be much worse the other way. Things will explode and
get rather
smoke
warm,
will
really,
come out. And all very exciting. But read the adapters. But most adapters these days will do both voltages easily.
That's all the correspondence, Andrew.
Oh, excellent.
Thank you.
It's good when I buy toys from the States anyway. It comes with a US power lead 9 times out of 10 these days. Mm. So chances are in your junk box, if you're like me, you tend to throw those adapters in a box going, I'll never use that. I can cut it off and put a real one on there. Chances are you've already got a power adapter. I've got millions of those, you know, the set, what we call a Sony lead, which is your IEC European things which plug into your VCRs and kettles and things like that. I've got millions of those with US plugs on them, so if anyone wants one, just drop me a line. I tend to chop them off and put Australian power leads on the back of it. Yeah, anyway, lots to do there.
Mm.
All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ryan, Justin's in this evening, Graham's in, and we might get Warlock fairly shortly when we push a few other buttons here. We're just a bit under the pump this evening. All right, interesting news. A lot of interesting news at the moment. I guess we can start off with something that's not on the rundown. How unusual for that. Anyone heard of Skipfish?
No.
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 What is a Skipfish?
Skipfish is a new security tool unveiled just today by Google. It's designed, well, actually, according to this, Google has released a development tool aimed at uncovering security holes in web applications. There was a well-known shopping center, online shopping center here in Australia that got, I think on Sunday, got done with malicious code. So when you search for it in Google, Google pops up a warning and says, don't go here. This is a bad site.
Ooh.
So
that won't do well for business?
No, especially when you rely on online transactions to make your crust.
So does the Google actually warn people away from clicking on that search result?
They check for malicious code installed on web servers when they trawl the web looking indexing pages,
when
really.
The site's indexed and ranked. Okay.
And if there's something nasty there, and of course, obviously, the big sites get indexed more frequently than your average home enthusiast site. Mm. And it keeps an eye on the technology that's there, and if it finds something that's like nasty, a Trojan or something like that, it'll flag it accordingly. So when it pops up the search results in Google and you click the link, you get the warning that comes up on the screen and says, don't go here, we recommend you don't.
But I wonder if this is similar technology to what they're using then when they're indexing and crawling. So this is designed to be downloaded by developers and used when you're writing web pages, is that right?
Correct. It's a bit of a test for you to see if you've got any holes in code or things that execute which shouldn't or permissions that are wrong. Because let's say, for example, you're developing a site which needs to write to a database or writes a bit of information that gets executed in a program on the web server. If someone can inject something nasty in there, then it'll go off and do things like spam and people can put little bots on there and key logging nasties and all sorts of things like that. So
this is a new feature that Google have added to their search engine?
Yeah, no. This is
a program.
Correct, its own standalone little application. Google said that the new tool dubbed Skipfish will allow developers to scan web page or web applications for possible security vulnerabilities. Currently in beta mode, the tool is designed to support multiple application frameworks, runs on Windows, Linux, Mac OS, and BSD operating systems. Google said that the speed and compatibility were the main priorities when designing the tool. It was written in C and engineered to run quickly whilst putting minimum strain on processors. So, well done, Google. They have another little tool that they've brought out. What are you chuckling about over there?
Even Google's own page, they're hedging their bets. They say the tool is believed to support Linux, FreeBSD, Mac OS, and Windows, Sigwin. So, yes, they're hedging their bets even then. So they probably haven't tested it on all those platforms, even though it probably will work.
Oh, look, it's Google. It'll be beta for 10 years.
Thank you. Yes, took the words right out of my mouth.
Gmail's just come out of beta, which is good. Another interesting news, AMD, which is the competitor to Intel when it comes to processing.
They make processors for computers.
The 6-core Thurban CPU details have been leaked, which is their new upcoming little beast. To which the headline really reads, AMD 6-core CPUs likely to offer less performance than Intel parts, but at a much lower price. So if you're not mission critical or you don't want to buy the latest and greatest i7, which goes at a million gazelles, then maybe have a look at some of the new AMD processors. Now, Graham, do you deal much with AMD processors?
Personally, I don't. I tend to stick with the Intel ones. But I know people who are exactly the opposite way around and can't stand Intel and will do anything other than use an Intel processor. So those people will be watching this with interest to see how it looks.
Well, I've built an AMD machine in my past life. And when you put it up and use regular processors on it, such as email, Word and things like that, you don't notice a difference.
No.
From a consumer point of view, they're terrific.
On a normal machine, they should work exactly the same. You shouldn't notice any particular difference. So it's just who's got the best performance for the best price on a given day. And different processors are always coming out from both companies.
It's certainly an option there, which will keep prices down. But I think it's a bit like buying your phone company provider. You choose the level of quality of service that you want. And if it meets the bill, then buy it. And it's the same with processors too. If you're really after high-speed gaming applications or you're surfing the web and doing strange things which require a lot of, you know, like playing online games and things like that, a good video card and a great CPU, you really can't go past. But if it's just day-to-day stuff, I'd give AMD a go.
So do we know if these things are PIN compatible with their Intel brothers?
Oh, no,
cousins?
That won't be.
They're not PIN compatible, but they're code compatible at some levels.
Yeah, yes.
So you'll need to choose your motherboard based on which processor you're going
to get.
Correct,
yes, definitely, yes.
And that's always been the case with AMD. But if you're buying them out of the... If you're just a consumer and going to your local shop and buying them, it's all done for you.
Yeah.
But if you're one of these enthusiasts like we all probably do here, you buy a motherboard to suit your application and build accordingly, then, yeah, you've got to be wary of the chipset that you get. So
generally, these days, no matter what you do, you buy your memory and your processor and your motherboard as one kit. You don't want to be, you know, if you need to change any one of those three, you're probably going to need to change all of those three.
Correct. How's memory going at the moment? It seems to be getting incredibly cheap again for the new stuff.
Memory just keeps getting cheaper and faster.
I've got to buy.
It's like bandwidth, isn't it?
It is.
Disk space.
It's funny. I look at the 4 gig. You remember the sticks that we used to have? We used to walk around and we thought, you know, 512 was big when they first came out. Well, now you don't think twice about carrying 16 gig or 32 gig on your key ring at the moment. And they're just keeping on getting cheaper and cheaper. I bought, 16 gig the other day for about $40, which was, you know, one of the faster named brand devices. And
Faster. So there's a difference, isn't there, in quality, in speed. The cheap ones can be slow.
Yes, you're right, Graham. If speed's the key, and it is with a 16 gig device, let me tell you, otherwise you're there forever copying stuff across onto it.
So you want to look carefully at the data transfer rate that you can achieve.
And of course, the other thing which is well worth considering is the fact that if you're putting large amounts on, chances are, buy something bigger than a DVD, because there's nothing worse than running out of space at that critical moment where you're trying to get 4.7 gig onto a 4 gigs.
4.7 gig being the size of one layer of DVD. A normal DVD that you write in your CD drive in your computer will be 4.7 gig. And dual layer discs are common for movies and things.
But getting back to memory too.
Double that size.
DDR. Dual inline memory. What's the other D stand for?
Double data rate.
We're up to DDR3.
Yes.
What's the difference, really, between DDR3 and DDR2? Is it a speed thing again? Is that really the difference, Graham, between the two?
Effectively, it's ways of achieving extra speed by having the memory clock, the clock that runs the memory, running at a higher speed than the bus that it talks with. So it can, if it takes two cycles for the memory to present the result on the output pins, it can... If it's running at double the rate, that will appear in one cycle of the machine's base rate.
So once again,
I think I've got that right. Have I got that right?
Does anyone know? Sounds pretty good. Yeah,
I wouldn't have been able to explain it.
I'll buy one.
So the reason why I was going there,
very technical.
A lot of consumers, they see these specifications and glaze over, but DDR is DDR3 is the current memory modules which are in the high-performance machines, you won't really notice the difference between DDR2, some of the earlier stuff. But if you're running high-performance or you want, you know, great gaming quality and all those sort of good things that come with it, that's the new stuff. So an i7 with DDR3 will go pretty fast.
Yes.
If you're shopping for those type of devices.
And, of course, it's not just whether it's DDR2 or DDR3, but the actual rate within that it runs. So DDR3 800 is going to be slower than DDR3 10,066 or whatever it is. There's different speeds.
Funny numbers, aren't there?
Yeah, there's funny numbers these days. But even just for ordinary use, and I'll extend what you said just a little bit. You do feel the difference with faster memory. You do feel the difference in performance on your machine. You know, it's just those things that you click and then you wait 10 seconds or you wait even 2 or 3 seconds, they happen that much faster. So instead of clicking and waiting 2 or 3 seconds, you know, tapping your finger on the desk, you click and it happens just a little bit quicker.
Good tip.
You do feel that difference.
All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ryan, JD, Graham and myself in this evening talking all things technological.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio, proudly sponsored by D-Link, building networks for people.
Hey, we heard on our show last week, Adam Turner took the couch up to wherever it is that he went, and he was talking about the boxy.
That
speaking
couch
of D-Link,
really gets around, doesn't
the
it?
The boxy
it's
box.
Always seems to be out somewhere else.
Yeah, it's a flying couch, isn't it? He's gone put it home. He's been listening to music this week, and if you hear the couch, I think I read it about a couple of days ago in one of his columns in the Sydney Morning Herald. But
he's anyway. in the chat room tonight.
Is he?
Oh, he's there. Yep.
My screen's gone dark on me. G'day, Adam. I should keep an eye on it. Anyway, the boxy looks really good. I had a bit of a look during the course of the week. It's a strange-looking thing, isn't it?
It is.
Diagonal, but it's got all the right ports on the back.
Is this the thing that had the Philadelphia experiment going on? It had sunk into the deck.
Yeah, it looked
is.
Like someone had put it too close to the toaster and it melted on the back left corner of it.
There's a comment on the forum about that. I'm just trying to find it.
But it won't fit in the 3-inch slot in their hi-fi.
That's right, with that sort of a shape. Interesting.
Yeah, good.
Well, I think Graham's got it right, though. It's, the Borg meets Philadelphia experiment or something.
Yes, that's exactly what it looks like. Yeah, because the square shape is very Borgish.
Yes. No, it's a very good little device that has been brought out by D-Link, and it's media streamer, but it's a media streamer on steroids. Does everything.
Mm.
The only thing it doesn't have, I suppose, is a digital tuner.
You don't need that.
Well, it depends if you want to record stuff off air or not. If you do, you need to be looking at something like a personal video recorder.
Yeah. Why would you want to watch anything that comes out of an Australian television network at the moment, the way they treat their viewers?
This is another debate, another argument for another time, Graham. But
the biggest criticism
my
of the
TV antenna at home doesn't work and I haven't fixed it.
Yeah. Really?
And I don't miss it.
Really?
Really.
Mm.
One of the biggest criticisms of the Apple TV is that you can't record TV on it out of the box. So there's obviously a fair number of people that don't believe the way you do, Graham.
Yeah, that's possible. That wouldn't be the first time I've been in a minority with my opinions.
Musketeer on our forum says, people need to stop releasing boxes and start releasing services that run on our existing boxes.
Yes, absolutely.
I already have a Foxtel IQ2, an Xbox 360, Popcorn Hour. And if I get in a boxy box, for example, do I really need another box? What I need is more services and more support.
Yeah, well, that's fair call.
And I think he goes on to say later, or someone does in the forum, that there's another medium coming out, another service coming out, and he's probably going to have to buy another box for that because it's not going to be TV compatible or internet compatible. I can't recall what it was, but it was another service that was being provided over the wire.
Mm-hmm. But it's the way it's all going to go, though. We're all going to get our media up our fibre link and stuff like that during the course of the future, which is going to come. And actually, let me see if I can just jump to something here. I'll just talk amongst yourselves while I actually try and find the article, which I'm concerned about. But during the course of the week, I saw the fact that someone's put a figure on running fibre to new homes and stuff like that, which was some exorbitant price.
Well, one would hope the National Broadband Network's considered this already.
Yes. Well, I think this is where it came from. Here we go. I knew I'd find it somewhere. Developers should expect to pay, developers being housing developers, not web developers or any other developer of that nature, developers should expect to pay some $2,500 on average to connect a new home with fibre for the National Broadband Network and between $400,000 and $700,000 for backhaul connections.
Mm.
That seems quite amazing. And this is from the federal government. The approximate costs were revealed as part of an explanatory memorandum in the Telecommunications Legislation Amendment, which is a bill that went before the Parliament. And the Department of Broadband Communications and the Digital Economy came up with $2,500 estimate for a FTTP, which is the fibre to the premises connection, as a midpoint figure amongst a number of available estimates. That's a lot of money to have a bit of glass brought into your house, isn't it? Where's the money going to go? $2,500? Is that obviously not from the pole? There must be a little hub or something in your street.
We think it's the last sort of 50 metres at most.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's a lot of money for fibre. Like, what?
You'll need equipment though. You know, some sort of device in your house to receive the signal that's coming in from the fibre and then to turn that into something you can use on a local network. Now, this actually leads into... Were you going to say something about Adam before we talk about what happened in Parliament last week?
Mm,
we started talking about Adam.
No, Adam's coming up after the break.
Oh,
I was just alluding to it there.
We're talking about
the boxy
couches and boxy boxes, and then we got one thing led to another.
It did.
And before you know it, it's the end of the show.
Correct.
Gadget website Nodspot coming up. No, sorry.
Hang on a minute.
you've just sent wee Warriors into panic.
into a dive, into a nosedive. Now, in Parliament last week, There was.
Oh yes, this is on top of the rundown. We should do this, shouldn't we?
Well, we should follow the rundown. It was something that was there was stuff that was discussed and there was stuff that wasn't discussed. But what this actually
it covers everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, oh yeah, it does. It does. What you're talking about here, though, with the cost of putting fibre into the home, the federal government has now introduced legislation that they want to make law, and it's going to be debated in Parliament involving a banning the installation of fixed line copper into new houses. So if developers are building what they call greenfield estates, which means they're building new housing estates in new areas, and all of the utilities, your electricity, telephone, water, sewerage, everything has to be put into this new estate, what the government wants to do is have a law which says you can't put copper wire into that new estate. Copper wire is bad. Copper wire is 19th century. We don't want it as part of our telecommunications infrastructure anymore. The law will say you must put in optic fibre and you must have fibre to the home, to every house in that greenfield estate. They've brought this in for discussion. The Labor government want to try and get it through.
Before the election?
The government is aiming to have the legislation in place by the 1st of July.
So yes.
Yes is the answer.
Is the answer to that?
Communications Minister Senator Stephen Conroy said it did not make sense for new houses to be fitted with copper technology when fibre was the way of the future. Now, I'm inclined to agree with Mr. Conroy, but it's created a big uproar in the building industry. Now, a gentleman by the name of Stephen Albin of the Urban Development Institute of Australia said the decision has caught many developers by surprise and will cause long delays in selling homes because they've already quoted and designed and started building homes on the basis that they're going to have basic telephone service. Yeah. But now if you think you're going to move into a new house in a month's time, you're not going to have a telephone until at least after the 1st of July.
What about the monopolistic attitudes of certain companies? Are we going to have an even playing field? Are we going to see multiple fibres so you can choose one company over another?
No, we'll have Telstra over there and Optus over here and National Broadband out the back.
But the carriers will compete for the greenfields estate. So Telstra will say, we'll cable it to you for your $2,000 per house. And then Optus might say, oh, we'll do it for you for $19.50 per house.
Yeah, but what's to say that once the cable's in and one company's received the tender that they don't go and hijack the consumer on the other end of it saying, well, you know, your rate is this, buy two or buy three or wherever how much they've had to bid to get into the...
That would be the function of the telecommunications regulator, and then you've such got, as it is.
Then you've got the cherry-picking options that come up as well, whereas, you know, if some groups, you know, some estates may not get it because the return on investment is not there.
It's interesting you should say that because there are areas, obviously, where Telstra has committed to providing telephone services. And now, based on this coming into Parliament, they've said, no, we're not going to provide telephones in there now. We're just going to sit on our hands and watch and wait and see what happens. And the developers are saying, but you can't do that. You've got to provide a phone service. And Telstra's saying, well, look, in a couple of months' time, we might be halfway through installing the copper and suddenly there's a law passed that says we're not allowed to. We've got to pull it all out and then put fibre in. So we're not going to do it.
Gee whiz, this is a strange world we live in, isn't it? Where this sort of stuff has become stalemate-ish. So this, you're telling me this all happened in Parliament this week. Is that what happened?
Yep, in the space of the last 7 days. So
Conroy moves quick, doesn't he?
He does. Telstra spokesman said the higher cost of fibre means that it's not viable for us to provide fibre to the premise without a contribution from developers. Some companies have been told these costs would be about $3,000. That's similar sort of ballpark to what you're talking, Andrew. You're saying $2,000 before. Could be more, could be up to $3,000. The costs will be levied only on greenfield sites. And the costs will be met by the national broadband network in existing urban areas.
So what does that mean?
Well, Mr. Conroy is coming from the point of view that he's deploying now a national broadband network. And it's going to be part of the NBN. It's not going to be part of Telstra's network. It's going to be part of the NBN.
Even if Telstra put it in?
Even if Telstra put it in. And he wants,
well, that's sensible.
It is sensible. And he wants everybody to compete for the business. And he's saying that if we had the perfect world where you've got Telstra retail separate from Telstra infrastructure, if Telstra infrastructure puts it in, then that's great. Telstra retail can then compete with Optus and everybody else.
To provide the services over that infrastructure.
Exactly right.
Yes. So will the NBN be controlling the price to the end user? Do you subscribe
no,
to...
The NBN sounds, will be controlling wholesale price.
It sounds awfully like insulation to me. But you just go away and you get a contractor to put it in and you
Peter
send your
Garrett's
bill
going
back,
to be the Minister for Communications after Senator
And you send your bill
Conroy.
Back to Senator Conroy and
Absolutely.
They pay it. There will be no competition in that at all.
No, I think it's a bit different to that.
I love Senator. It's great. Isn't it? It's healthy in the studio tonight too.
Yes, if you don't know what that reference is to, overseas listeners, Google Australia insulation fire debacle downfall of Labor government. And
and put in the word Garrett in there somewhere as well. Garrett. Yeah,
find out what we're talking about.
And it's not beds are burning either.
The legislation that was what was left out of Parliament last week.
Oh yes, ins and outs. This is good. Off you go.
Where's
President Obama for a start?
Yeah, so
he's been left out of Parliament now.
He was noticeable by his absence as well, wasn't he?
We all know why he didn't come. Yes. Imagine spending a night with the Rudds. Oh, sorry.
Guess what it says in the new net filter? Oh, that's harsh. Mr. Rudd might be listening. He might get his internet
advice for dinner. You'll get a sermon. And let me say this. Sorry.
Guess what's in the new net filter legislation?
President Obama's personal site? No?
No one knows.
No.
No. Wasn't introduced. It was missed. The date was missed. The current sitting of Parliament is now over and done with, and we've got to wait months yet before the next opportunity for Mr. Conroy to introduce the proposed net filter legislation for discussion.
I don't think we're going to see it in this current term. I really don't. I think there's too much riding on it. It's interesting, too, that both federally, Australia has an election, and also the UK have a federal election, or whatever their equivalent of a federal election is over in the UK. And we'll talk a little bit about what they're up to. They did some fairly interesting things. I'd almost call it draconian with what they've been doing with broadband over there. And remember how we had let's talk about it now. Remember how AFACT had a little go at iiNet recently in the courts here in Australia? Mm-hmm. Over copyright and what they're using.
A little
ago,
they had a massive go and they got shot down and they're appealing.
They did.
Appealing the decision.
They did. It'll be interesting to see what they actually appeal with because, once again, in the millions of the reams of forest, we don't execute trees in here. We just mow them down whilst we do the show. Says he's looking for another news release. But what happened was in the UK, what they're doing in the House of Commons at the moment, there is a bill before them which they're about to vote on, which means that if a movie house suspects an individual or anything of piracy, they can actually go directly to the ISP and request the information, the IP address, and who had that IP address at that time. So they can, rather than go to the ISP, they can go straight to the end user and tackle them on the breach of copyright.
So the equivalent here would be the AFACT consortium, which is comprised of all the movie houses and Channel 7, TV networks, all those sorts of people. They could go directly to iiNet, for example, or Netspace or whoever, and say, who's using this IP address at the moment, please? And they would be required by law to give them that information.
Correct.
That's a lot of power, isn't it?
It is. And like in this country, we have a magistrate or a judge that sits in between that request and delivery of such requests. But over there, the UK government is basically going to force ISPs to crack down on the copyright abuse. As I said in the opening of this evening, it's going to cost anywhere up between £250 and £500 million to do this, and that's just in not so much enforcement, but just in rolling out the technology which is going to do this. And this is part of the Digital Economy Bill, which has passed the Lords and is waiting debate in the Commons. So I'm going to get my British parliamentary terms there. So I think it's gone past the Greenhouse and it's up in the Senate now. So this should be set against a potential $283 million benefit to rights stakeholders. The assessments were published ahead of further progress on the legislation, which may be caught up in a rush to salvage as much as possible of the government's outstanding legislation before the general election on May the 6th. Mm. So it's watch out in the UK.
Yeah.
My
suggestion.
After you.
No, I was going to say my suggestion to anybody interested in that process in the UK is to grab a passing law student and ask them to define due process.
Yes, because that's what I was going to say. It sounds as though it can be awfully open to abuse in terms of checking on your competitors, for example.
Well, and also dobbing in your mate, really, if you think about it. Mm. You know, if someone who's working in the process decides to have a vindictive go at a colleague, friend or whatever, what's to say that they can't be fraudulently created and passed on to a movie house saying that things were downloaded when they actually weren't? And where does the onus of proof have to be? Who has to prove what?
Now, all these AFACT-type consortiums, they obviously monitor peer-to-peer traffic. They've got their own servers and their own software and their own systems, and they monitor who's sharing what chunks of what.
It doesn't take much to see who's in a peer-to-peer room. No, it doesn't at all. Its IPs are there for all to see.
Exactly. So they would be doing this, but it's a lot of giving them a lot of power and a lot of authority just to be able to say, well, we want to know who is on this IP address at this particular date and time. I wonder what oversight there is going to be of the management of that information. It'll be interesting. If you've got any thoughts on this and you're a UK listener and you've been following the debate in the UK, send us an email, feedback@techtalkradio.com.au.
All right, before we go to the break, because I do need to get my power supply for my netbook, it keeps on going black on me, so I can't see what's going on. The New South Wales Police steps up anti-piracy raids. Both film industry investigators and the New South Wales Police have busted a video store allegedly selling DVD pirated stuff in Marrickville, which is in Sydney's inner west. Officers raided the store and seized 1,500 allegedly pirated films and a burner operation. Doesn't come much more red-handed than that, really, does it? And the other telltale sign is it had Avatar written on the label. So I think that's laid down Mazaire, and they say.
If I told the police, no, it's all personal use, yeah, that only goes so far, doesn't it? That excuse. Yeah.
So, like, they're the people that the authorities do need to target, and that's a successful outcome, I would suspect, for all. Yes. It'll go before a court, and they will do what courts do. So, allegedly, that's what they've been caught doing, red-handed. As opposed to what some people are doing and trying to find people not quite so red-handed, but IP-handed, I guess, in the way that technology works. All right, you are listening to Tech Talk Radio. Take a break. Back with View from the Couch after this.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show.
Tech Talk Radio.
Yes, I had a very bad experience with this phone.
From a control freak of a company that made the device.
Does that surprise anybody in this room?
Oh, okay. This is a different world.
Oh, yeah. There's got to be one in every country. Is he trying to censor the internet too?
Maybe this should be in / rant.
You'd have to have a screen that reflected the image, preserving the polarisation.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
What do you mean? I don't know. I've got lots of buttons over here.
Careful. I'll click one to shut us up.
You might.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, proudly sponsored by D-Link, building networks for people.
All right, it's time to open the proverbial can of worms. CDs or DVD? CDs or downloads? Digital downloads.
Serious now, are we? Digital downloads. CDs are dead.
Gutsy. Graham?
Half and half.
Half and half. Oh, that's not the answer I was expecting from you. The man who used to love 44K uncompressed CD, 50 meg tracks, no?
The last 100 songs that you have had to listen to.
To listen to, yeah.
That you've got. However, you've got them. Have you got them off audio CD or have you obtained them digitally by copying files or downloading files, buying them from iTunes, buying them from an online music store? Podcasting.
Digitally.
Digitally,
yeah,
see?
Same to say.
So despite what Graham said, he's lying to your face, Andrew. He's 100%...
No, he's just got lazy. He likes his CD.
But you're still pro CD in the media, are you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I must admit, I'll still spend the dollars. If you're going to spend the dollars and buy it as a digital download, for an extra couple of bucks, I don't mind getting the thing to put on the shelf. You know what I mean? I like something tangible.
But you've got to leave the house and get dressed and into, you know, relate with people.
No,
and
you
use
don't.
Real money and, don't you?
No, you don't. You just click the button and go buy now and whack your card in.
Yeah.
And it arrives in the mail.
Absolutely.
Box from Sanity arrives on your doorstep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. Speaking of buying things, remind me to talk to the listeners about a great new way of buying stuff from America online, which I've discovered thanks to the Commonwealth Bank.
Oh, yeah.
Should I talk about it now?
Yeah,
now
talk about it now. Now, yeah.
When you travel overseas, you want to cash in a foreign country, obviously, to use. Now, traditionally, if you take your MasterCard or your Visa card or whatever card you have and you go to a place like the United States, GD, listen up. You need to know this.
GD, switch on.
You actually get pinged each time you make a transaction in the foreign
transaction
country.
Fees, yeah.
Correct. And the currency conversion fee, and everyone takes
that
cut.
Oh, okay, because your Visa card statement is in Australian dollars.
Correct.
And if you buy something in the US, they charge you in US dollars and someone has to do a conversion, they charge you for that.
Oh, everyone takes their cut as you go from one currency to the other and a bit here and a bit there and all that sort of stuff. Even a cash out at a teller machine in a foreign country costs you big time. Well, not wanting to promote any specific bank, but the bank that I work with, which I just mentioned earlier, have a traveler's credit card, which you can buy for $15. When I went to get my money the other day, they said, you should get one of these. And you buy the credit card in US dollars or whichever currency you want, which means when you shop online, if you wanted to, like if you're doing a big transaction, for example, you're buying something big from a foreign country, rather than cop the massive, huge commission that they take on a couple thousand dollars US.
Exorbitant, which, outrageous.
Yeah, I bought some software from Abbott.
Inproportionate, disproportionate.
You got the thesaurus open again, have you? I bought some software, $2,500 US. They wanted, I lost $300 in commissions just by doing the transaction fee.
Ouch.
Yeah, it was ouch. Whereas if I'd known then what I knew now, go down and buy yourself a credit card.
$15 US dollars card.
Yeah, and you just whack your currency on there.
But you still have to do a conversion somewhere.
Yeah, when you buy the card. So buy it now, because 92 cents at the moment. Go and buy your cash now and leave it on the card.
But what if it's 94 cents tomorrow?
Buy it tomorrow.
Okay.
And if it's 96 cents, then buy it then.
But
and
generally speaking, buying currency is better than selling currency. You end up ahead.
Yes. So. Anyway, you can leave this money sitting on this card, which you can then buy stuff like Amazon and stuff, and you don't pay.
Oh, so even if you, so you use it while you're traveling, but if you come home and you've still got some US dollars on, it doesn't matter because you use it on Amazon and on.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and you can actually you can get people to put money into the card for you in US if you want to.
Oh, very good.
So it's very handy. But it was a really good way, travel money, they call it, and you don't pay all the exorbitant, you know, ka-ching conversion fees when you when you travel. So there you go, GD. There's another tip on Tech Talk Radio. You heard it here first. What were we talking about? Music.
Technology and financial advice.
You will have stock market very shortly on this show.
No.
We're going to. dear. Yes, downloads and music. The quality I've found, personally, if you get the right stuff and from the right places, is very good. Because we started off with really ordinary 128K things, and they were watery and...
Yeah, and you really did feel like you got ripped off if you paid good money for something like that and it sounded, you know, not the best. And
well,
certainly not as good as a CD.
Used to be an advocate of that sort of thing.
But these days, there's real, you know, if you get something that's AAC encoded and at a good strong bit rate and it doesn't have DRM on it.
Yeah, there's the challenge, DRM, digital rights management.
Well, at the Apple iStore, you can get stuff that's exactly in that format, and it sounds okay.
Why doesn't the film industry take note of what's happened to the audio industry?
Because they're dinosaurs, morons, idiots.
Okay, that's Graham's thought. Anyway,
well, you asked the question.
I did.
You knew that was the answer, didn't you?
I did, but you said it. anyway, Adam Turner on the couch. He's got a view on this, as you would expect from the couch about CDs and DVDs and well, not DVDs, but audio downloads.
With legit music download services going great guns, is the audio CD living on borrowed time? I can't remember the last time I played an audio CD. Actually, computers aside, I don't think there's even a CD player plugged in anywhere in the house. I bought a 5-disc CD player a few years ago and didn't even bother to plug it in again when I moved house. It's now gathering dust on a shelf in my office alongside the cassette deck and the mini disc deck. All my music is digitized and streamed to speakers around the house from iTunes on Windows or Mac, or streamed from an Apple TV. I might not be able to remember the last time I played an audio CD, but that doesn't mean I don't buy music on CDs. Just this week, I did a little early birthday shopping for myself. I picked up some Stevie Ray Vaughan, some Albert King, some Buddy Guy, all on Amazon. These CDs will be delivered in a few weeks and tucked away until my birthday. When I rip off the wrapping paper, the first thing I'll do is rip the songs to my MacBook and then copy them to my Apple TV and my iPhone. Then the discs will safely get stored in the cupboard, ready to call upon if disaster strikes or if I just want to rip the songs in a different format. Now, I admit that I live a very iTunes-centric lifestyle, but I refuse to buy music from iTunes or from any other digital download service. I'd much rather own the CD and then rip the songs in the format and the bitrate that suits me. That way I'm not locked into any one technology, device or format. I think that kind of flexibility makes it worth forgoing the convenience and price advantage of digital downloads. Actually, digital downloads don't always work out much cheaper either. My 3 CDs from Amazon cost me $59 Australian, including delivery. Had I bought them at a sanity store in Australia, they would have cost me $65 plus delivery, or else time and petrol to go to the shops. Had I bought them on the Australian iTunes store, they would have cost me $53. So shopping for CDs on Amazon saved me $6 plus a trip to the shops, while I'm still left with the physical CDs in my hands. Shopping on the Australian iTunes store would have saved me another $6, but required me to forgo the CDs, which is a sacrifice I'm not prepared to make for $2 a CD. Also, I know my kids will enjoy wrapping up the CDs for my birthday and then watching me unwrap them. That magic is lost when you move to digital downloads. The reason I've been thinking about digital downloads is that I've been tempted to buy my first iTunes album this week, the Chess Blues Rock Songbook. It's a classic blues collection, and it seems to be a bit of a rarity. The double CD sells for $45 new on Amazon, and I couldn't see the CD on sale anywhere on Australian websites. Meanwhile, it's only $23 on the Australian iTunes store. Big Pond Music even has it for $16.50. At less than a half price, I might be prepared to make an exemption just this once and buy the album as a digital download. It's tempting to speculate that digital downloads might kill off CDs within 5 or 10 years, but I'd say that's very unlikely. Remember, I'm a 30-something here debating about the merits of Amazon versus iTunes. Well, there are plenty of older Australians who don't even own computers. Of those who do own computers, many would use them for email and web surfing, not as an integral part of their home entertainment system. If CDs do die out in the next decade, it will certainly be to make way for another physical format. It will be at least a generation, if not two, before all Australians are willing and able to make the switch to digital music downloads. Meanwhile, I'm sticking with CDs.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And as the other show continues here in the studio, what were you guys talking about over the other side of the panel there? Something about
nothing,
shirts.
Nothing. Yeah. Face to front.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Ellen raises an interesting point there, and that is a very, very good argument for...
You were listening.
The cloud. Of course I was listening. The cloud.
Yes.
Everything's in the...
Music's out there.
Well, for everything. If you put everything in the cloud, then you're not going to be hindered by changes of formats and different media coming and going. We had this problem... I had this problem personally about... 12 months ago or something, I found a heap of discs that had important code on it that I wanted to retrieve from about 10 years ago or 12 years ago. I thought, I must have a look at that project. I wanted to get some code out.
Really?
Yeah, and the media was LS120 discs.
Oh, I remember. They were those 3.5-inch things that sort of were ahead of their time.
That's
right. I've got a reader for those still, if you
want. Oh, thank you. I found a reader, but I had to hunt around for a reader, and I thought, look, I've got a lot of valuable information on these discs, and unless I'm always moving stuff from one medium to another, as technologies evolve, and like Adam was saying there, with CDs, what are we going to be doing in 10 years' time or 2 years' time? You're going to have stuff on CDs, and people are going to be saying, CD-ROM... Don't know if I can read that anymore. No, I don't have a machine that does CDs anymore. I don't have a machine that does 5.25-inch discs, 3.5-inch discs anymore. LS120s, no. DAT tapes, we're talking about, Graham, no.
Yeah, what ever happened to DAT? DAT's still used in the industry, though.
Is it?
Sort of.
Sort of? No, not really.
Yeah, things are floating around. Everyone uses WAV files now, email.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We can see the writing on the wall for our mini discs.
You don't need DAT if you've got a memory stick.
The writing on the wall's in capital letters, Dr. Ron.
The mini disc is dead. Dead as a dodo.
And I remember reading a commentary somewhere that
except
said
for that one, works. And that one.
The Generation
two
X.
Two here in the studio. It's dead.
They're the last two.
Generation X will go down as the generation that had to keep on buying their same music over and over and over on
multiple
formats.
That's very true when you think about it, isn't it? Absolutely. And when you lose things, like if you have a hard drive crash and you haven't got it backed up, then there goes an album, there goes $16. There's a lot of money to lose there. I mean, when I bought this new little...
An album? What about a library?
Yes.
What about 23,000 songs?
Yeah, well, you should back them up. That's why I like something tangible in my hand that you can put on the shelf if I'm going to buy it.
Mm. Well, but what do you back it up to?
You put it on the shelf.
And then if your hard disk crashes, you just have to sit there and
rip it again.
Yeah, you spend a whole weekend ripping all your CDs again.
Cloud computing, stick it out there. Let someone like Google worry about it.
And then your storage provider goes bust and end up in receivership and you've lost all your stuff again.
That's what I like about you, Graham. You can find the negative in anything. No, the cloud computing option, though, is quite valid because when you buy, like, this little netbook that I have on the table here, the company that I bought it off offers, I think it's about a gig or... 3 or 4 gig or something like that of free cloud computing so that you can store off your device on the cloud. And if you wanted to, you can put your pictures there, you can put your music there, you can put all your priceless treasures up there as a backup, because nothing beats an off-site backup now, does it, boys?
Well, that's true.
Even your family photos, good spot. Burn them to something, give them to your family so that if your place gets done by whatever, tempests, snowballs,
locusts, that sort of thing.
Yeah, if it gets raised to the ground that way, at least you've got a backup of all those sort of things. And it's so easy to do in the digital age.
As Dr. Run says, though, you can't just archive and forget. You've got to maintain your archive of stuff. You've got to make sure, yep, can I still read that disc? Is it a format that I can still get a reader for? Do I need to transfer it to another format? You've got to maintain your archive. And, CDRs, they have a limited life. You burn them and 10 years later you can't read them.
The surface starts flaking away and, yeah.
Because it's a dye-based thing, isn't it?
Mm.
It's ink. And I've moved to the wonderful world of burning Blu-rays. Have I told you that? That's an experience. Well, should I say, Brian had the experience. He had to burn some stuff off to a Blu-ray and then take it off down to the local Gold Class Cinema at one of the movie chain houses and play something up there on a private screening. That wasn't a challenge, let me tell you.
I bet.
But the media price of Blu-rays come down quite a bit too. It's down to about $7 a disc for a half-decent one, or you can buy 10, I think, for $35.
Yeah, I can remember when DVDs started off that way.
Mm.
When, you could buy cheap CDs, but to burn a DVD, that was a big thing.
Yeah, you buy a cheap DVD burner for $1,200 or $1,500.
And that's right, back when they first came out. Mm. And now they come with your cornflakes virtually.
Well, your best bang for your bucks, I think, these days is a hard drive if you want to back stuff up. You can't go wrong for 1.5 terabytes for about $120, can you?
That's right, yeah.
And you can put in another machine portable drive or something.
The 5.25-inch floppy drives in the late 70s, when I got into the old Apple II stuff, was about the same price. They were about $10 a disc, and the disc drive was in the $1,500 mark. So,
Graham, you and I were probably having a conversation in around about 1989, buying a new computer, saying, are you going to spend the extra money and get high-density 5.25-inch drives? You can save 1.2 megabytes of data on one of those things.
Instead of 360K,
Who was that voice, Andrew, that I heard in my headphones there laughing and...
Oh, is he going to talk to us?
Oh, he might.
Oh, hello. Come in. Yeah, Sydney correspondent Warlock. Are you there, Warlock?
Yes, I certainly am. How's it going, guys?
He was laughing at me talking about 5.25-inch.
Oh, is that who you're hearing in your headphones?
It was.
Yeah. Warlock, you're an audiophile, aren't you? You're into audio. What do you reckon, CDs or digital downloads?
I prefer digital downloads just because it's so easy to do everything. I've got a bunch of CDs sitting in my cupboard that I just don't use. Once I put them all through iTunes and got all the audio out of it, I was quite happy after that just to use the digital all the time.
So how do you back your stuff up?
As for the photos and other backups you were talking about, I recently set up a free 5-gig Microsoft Mesh account, which synchronizes whichever folders I right-click on them and say, sync this up to the cloud. And for my photos, I've got an account with Picasa, which has a really cool application that you can use as a web application, and it all syncs up, and it keeps you a free 1 gig there because... the reason I got that was Flickr started complaining that I had too many photos and they were going to limit the number that were visible on my Flickr account. So I looked around for something else and found Google's Picasa works really well. It's got a fantastic, easy-to-use desktop application, which also has built-in facial recognition. So you can have 2,000 photos of your friends and family, tag which ones look like who and tell it, and it automatically goes through and asks you if all these other ones look like the same person. You can just say yes, and then you can upload it. You can set up...
That's a bit scary, isn't it?
Particularly in the hands of Google.
You can set up private folders.
Especially in the hands of Google, as JD said, yeah.
Well, I'm fine with Google. I don't have any problem with them, but I've got a private folder up there that I've got photos of my daughter I don't want other people to see, but I just add on email account access for friends and family who I do want to be able to see those photos, and the rest of them I allow to be public, so that works out quite well for me.
And, of course, you've got Flickr and those sort of sites, which you can also probably store photos on if you really wanted to and make them private. But tell me about Microsoft Mesh. How did you go with that?
Microsoft Mesh is easy. It's free. You get 5 gigabytes to fill up with whatever you like. You install a small application on your desktop, and then you can go either use that application or just go into any folder on your computer, right-click it, and say, make this an FT Mesh one, Microsoft Mesh one, and it automatically starts syncing it up to the web while you're connected.
I guess you've got to draw everyone's attention to extra bandwidth on their internet account if it does that all in the background, but... From a
That's right, especially if you've got something like an AINet Naked DSL that counts your uploads, or Telstra often does that with some of their accounts as well. But this works quite well for me. We've got about 100 gigs a month that we never get anywhere near. So it's always handy. And then you can access any of those files from their website at any time. And you can also install the application on any other computer and type in your account details, and bang, you've got it all down there as well.
So what about audio, Warlock? If you've got a fairly sizable library and at high quality, 5 gig isn't really going to go that far, is it?
No, well, like all the others, you can also add on extra gigabytes, and they've got other companies like Carbonite Backup and Back Me Up and stuff like that that you can pay for accounts. Each of them have got a small limited free account, but I think Microsoft one was just easy, and 5 gigabytes was as much as I needed.
It sort of points to cloud computing being or covering a few of these alternatives, doesn't it, Dr. Ron?
It does. I've used Carbonite. I've used the trial version, and that works very, very well. It takes a long time for everything to slowly upload over a few days or weeks, depending on how much data you're going to have backed up. But once it is backed up and it just runs on your computer and it just automatically updates files as you update them, and it sends the updated version up to your account, and it works very, very well. So I'd recommend Carbonite if people want some sort of backup or storage solution like that.
But do you need to pay a bounty to Jabba the Hutt to get it back out again? Or?
No, well, you pay a subscription so that you can access then your file at any time.
That was very funny.
Yeah, it's a one-off, but it's not like, you know, it's not right. You know, based on the amount of bandwidth you're using. But be aware, if you have an account that meters your uploads, then that might have an effect on your monthly internet account as well.
Yes.
Which is where I'd like to see sort of a bit of a fusion between the paid streaming accounts and private accounts. So that, for example, you know, we'll pick iTunes just because I'm an Apple buff. If iTunes have got all the songs that I'm interested in listening, I'd pay a subscription and listen to whatever I wanted to listen to from their library, but still need a private section for things that they don't have on sale that I've bought, you know, the CD for, or I've downloaded from another site, and have it in my private reserve, so to speak, that isn't publicly available, but available to me through the same mechanism. Because the last thing you want to do is to go to an iTunes application and then your own private application and potentially a third one to just listen to music non-stop.
I've got a question about iTunes. You buy something, it disappears after a while. Like, should you be able to re-download it again if you have a catastrophe, and iTunes remembers what you've already bought? Wouldn't that be logical?
There's an element of that.
Applications for the iPhone, or that remembers which ones you've already purchased, so that could also work for audio. One of the other things that's happening a lot in America now, I've noticed, because of the amount of huge bandwidth and almost unlimited accounts that they get over there with their quotas, a lot of people are moving from downloading using iTunes and Amazon MP3 store to just buying a streaming account, and they hit stream on whatever they want. They love Pandora Radio and that sort of thing over there.
We used to have Pandora in this country until the fun police got to it and said, no, it hasn't had the rights paid for it here. Is there any alternatives in Australia to Pandora yet?
I've seen a mention of some upcoming new streaming-type audio systems, but I can't remember the name of it offhand.
The thing I used to like about Pandora, and we spoke to the creator of Pandora, whose name eludes me at the moment, but that was great because you could choose music, and if you tick the box and said, I like this, or you tick the box and said you didn't like it, it would throw similar style of music to you. So as a result, you would end up listening to music that was your cup of tea, for want of a better term, and I thought that was terrific.
I think also that's what a lot of people were thinking why Apple recently bought the company Lala, was to do a lot more streaming of music rather than storing and downloading.
Okay.
Mm. And also to keep it out of the hands of Google, but that's another story.
Oh, well, yes, isn't it? So, all right.
I wonder if there's not an opportunity here for ISPs to do deals with both movie and TV production people, as well as music companies and so on. We're obviously at some point going to get some sort of video on demand. They're going to have to put a little server in every telephone exchange to provide, you know, so you can click on an episode of Lost and it'll come streaming down to you in real time over the fibre network.
Well, there needs to be some caching, doesn't it? Otherwise, they're going to put a hell of a lot of stress on the network.
And if they do it that way, put it in each exchange, that sort of thing. I wonder if there's also so we can have our video on demand, all our audio on demand. We don't need to actually own the CD or the music. We just subscribe to something that's on demand that comes down our fibre link. Now, if they've got a server there already, there's also an opportunity for them to say, well, look, we'll sell you space on this server to back up to as well. So all these backup services could use that same infrastructure, and it could be metered either differently or not at all than your normal internet access. So you don't have to pay for the uploads to back up your data to their little server sitting in the exchange that's also doing their media streaming.
Mm. So that's this is like a geographic local cache.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
All right, just a quick whip around the panel before we go to the break. Graham, do you have a CD player connected and plugged into your anywhere in your abode at this point in time? Or are you...
One in the car.
No, inside. I've got one in the car too. Came with it. That doesn't count.
No, I wouldn't.
And DVD players don't count either.
Yes and no. Yes, I've got one connected up, but it's not to the main sound system.
Dr. Ron?
I have two independent CD players set up with their own stereos, those own,
well, that's good.
Own speakers.
I'm pleased to hear that.
One of them I use quite a bit. The other one, not so much.
JD?
Yes, I do. Yeah, separate CD.
One, two, three, or we're going
to... Well, I've got a big one connected to my main stereo, and I've got a small one in the kitchen.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Good. Well, okay, you place for CD players. You got one?
I've got CD players. I just don't use them for... The only thing I've got is like a CD player in the computer, which is DVD, and I just use it to install software. I don't use it for even watching movies or anything like that.
Good. You're more modern than everyone else.
Also... something else that Adam was just mentioning that I was just about to as well.
Try typing with two hands.
Called Guvira.com.
Okay.
Australians will soon be able to legally download music, movies, and their favourite TV shows via the internet for free as long as they're prepared to put up with advertising.
Yeah, well, that's what we do at the moment with free-to-air television. That's how that's funded, with advertising. Why wouldn't it work in a downloaded environment?
It's even better here, as I understand it. The ad's at the beginning, but it's not during the broadcast. So,
well, that's got to be good. There's a certain a cable company at the moment that's trying to get people to subscribe to them by saying that there's no ads in their sport. Wonder who that could be.
Yes, there's not many around.
No, absolutely. All right, Tech Talk Radio, back with more after this.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, proudly sponsored by D-Link, building networks for people.
Now, let's talk about Freeview.
Hey, someone just joined the wave.
They're the people I want to avoid the calls from.
Comes in very handy, especially when your files get really, really big and corruption takes place.
So you went, A.
Dude, it's not even a beta. It's just for us to play around with.
They also cited taxes and freight costs.
Just mount it on your desktop and run it direct.
It's a big risk.
So you watch the webcam.
Yeah.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Wow, there you go. Welcome back. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. We've got Dr. Ron, Justin Dunlop and Graham Callaghan in this evening. We have, if you just joined us, you've missed Adam Turner, but you can download that on the podcast. Mm. We can get all sorts of podcasty things. You can get Adam Direct if you like.
There's a special Adam Only podcast.
There is an Adam Only podcast.
If you don't like the rest of us.
Yeah, good. And
how come Adam gets his own special podcast?
Because he's easy to edit out. He comes in one piece. We're a bit more tricky than
he's
that.
He's packaged.
He's packaged. Absolutely. He is packaged. He's on the chat at the moment too. If you want to talk to him about speed humps on a road near you or something like that, he's there. If you've caught up with those articles he wrote recently. Anyway, and also... we've got Warlock joining us from Sydney, also on Skype this evening. The Manic Minute's going to be the Manic Half Hour, because we really haven't got through much this evening that was on the rundown, but a couple of interesting things that are probably noteworthy. Virgin Mobile, they got done for spam the other day. Did you know?
What did they do?
Anyway, Virgin Mobile has agreed to establish new training programs, quality assurance processes, and an auditing regime following the ACMA investigation into emails that it had sent to its customers. The investigation revealed that Virgin Mobile customers who had opted out of receiving marketing messages from the company still received emails promoting the benefits of opting in. That's quite annoying, really, isn't it?
We know you opted out, but please opt in.
If you think about that, it's obviously someone's read... There's, you know, a Boolean thing in a database somewhere which is true and false, and someone just omitted to detect that or read that before they went off and sent all the emails. But anyway, it says, when you joined us, you asked not to receive any promotional material. Virgin emailed its customers in July 2009. Then it said, we totally respect the decision. You can remain promo-free as long as you like. But anyway, they copped
except
a few.
For this promo.
Yeah, so Virgin Mobile has agreed to pay $22,000 in addition to developing its training, quality assurance processes, and auditing processes. Once again, 22 grand's a drop in the ocean for a company like Virgin Mobile. And I'm sure for 22 grand, that's a price that's well worth paying if you wanted to contact a whole heap of people that had chosen not to be opted in. Anyone here Virgin customer? I don't think we are in this. No, there must be a few. That must have been the whole database that they sent something to then, if that's the case. I wonder if that's true. The proportion of the fine is gives an indication of the customer base that they sent to. Because doesn't the ACMA penalise based on the number of emails sent? Is that how they develop their fine regime?
Yeah, I think so. They look at the volume sent.
Because I think Optus have copped a $110,000 fine, I think, late last year for doing the same thing, sending...
Yeah, that's how they calculate the penalty, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So, obviously, the customer base or the database for Virgin wasn't too flashing there. Now, other interesting news too. Have you ever considered not having an IT department in a fairly large organisation? I know you guys work for large organisations, but could you imagine not having... Well, actually, that's probably a leading question. Don't answer that. could you imagine not having an IT, in-house IT department? Well, Toyota Australia are looking at just that, not having an in-house IT. It's basically placing all its bets on the cloud computing model and is on a mission to rid itself of any enterprise IT infrastructure within 5 years.
Okay, so that's a different question again. That is, do I want to have Microsoft Office on all my workstations, or do I want to point people to a web browser, to a website, and let the host take care of all the tech problems? That's interesting.
Is that a gutsy call, or is that just the changing sign of the times, do you think, with when it comes to business computing? Because I must admit, I've looked at that for our business as well, whereas I've looked at the Google, what they call it, Google Apps. Is that what they call it?
Yeah.
Where you get the mail and the word. We're running trial accounts now at the moment just to give it a run and see how well it works.
Hmm. But they're going beyond that. They're saying no infrastructure. Is that what you said?
They're on a mission to rid themselves of any enterprise IT infrastructure within 5 years.
Wow.
So everything will be connected to the internet, and the internet will do everything.
Well, and it's up to it.
So the only thing that the server will do will be a print server, maybe a file server.
But if they get rid of all the infrastructure... That doesn't make much sense to me. They need some sort of infrastructure.
Yeah.
They can't just say to their employees, go buy a computer. Yeah, let us know your email address.
Well, Michael Jenkins, the manager of enterprise architecture and strategy at Toyota Australia, boldly told the CBIT Dataflow conference in Sydney that he is looking forward to a future in which all applications are delivered via the cloud from data centres that are completely transparent and invisible. Gutsy call, I reckon. Mm. But nonetheless... It takes a large organisation to really put their faith in a cloud computing company.
But it does mean all your sensitive business information is out there in the cloud, probably on somebody else's server.
Well, it definitely means that, doesn't it? Hmm. Is that a problem for privacy issues? Only if someone gets hacked, I guess, really, isn't it?
Well, not so much. I mean, yes, there's privacy issues, but there's certainly commercial issues if somebody else hacks in and gets your intellectual property.
Yeah, and I guess it wouldn't work for some organisations which handle, I guess... personally sensitive material.
Like credit card numbers?
Exactly. Credit cards, medical records, police records, any records for that matter, which are, if they fell into the wrong hands, would be quite detrimental. But anyway, that's a big, bold move by Toyota. In other interesting news, Vivid Wireless unveils Perth WiMAX prices. Don't know whether you heard about this, but Vivid Wireless...
WiMAX. Are we still contending with WiMAX?
Whatever happened to WiMAX? It got relegated to the west of the country. Hello, if you're listening to us in WA at the moment, but you're the lucky contenders here. Vivid Wireless have released the prices for their wireless broadband service in Perth, with its largest plan costing $99 per month for a whopping 40 gig of data. The plans were available either month to month or under a 24-month contract. The service would be throttled to 64K when you do naughty things. And the prices, actually, you can get add-on packs for $20 for an extra gig, costing $10 per gig on average. Probably not the
I
most...
America's heading more towards LTE than WiMAX these days.
Well, so is Australia, because Telstra announced today, Warlock, that... Oh, yeah, today? Maybe yesterday, that they're actually going to embark upon LTE, which is sort of not quite fourth-generation technology, but it's the next rung up from 3.5G.
Yeah, it's like a competitor with WiMAX. Also, there's been rumours recently of seeing an iPhone with WiMAX running on it.
Oh, yes. We get those rumours. It's amazing what people find in web logs. And
it's amazing what you can do in Photoshop as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, Justin...
It was on a Sprint commercial.
Well, that'll explain it, won't it? Sorry, Dr. Roman, you were going
to
say?
Yeah, Justin used to be a user of WiMAX, I think. Is that right? You used to have a WiMAX.
No.
No? I'm thinking of three other fellas, am I?
Probably.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone who's used WiMAX.
Disregard.
That was going to be the backbone of part of the National Broadband Network.
It was, and then they canned it.
Until it got canned. That was $17 million well spent, thanks to Mr. Conroy.
LTE stands for Long-Term Evolution, by the way. That's what that acronym
is. Yeah, and I think
is.
Mark sent a piece about it the other day. Mark is Tech Talk Radio's on-the-ground person rolling out LTE in Boston in the United States. And I'll stand corrected on this, but I do recall his email saying that the achievable data rates weren't that much better than 3.5G. So it's all based on, like everything in radio waves, how far you are and what sort of coverage and how many other people are on the network at the one time to determine how fast you go.
And the ads will say speeds of up to 480 megabits per second with a little asterisk, and then down the bottom it'll say, yeah.
Yeah, not in your lifetime.
May vary.
At your performance outside of the lab may vary.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely.
Now, Andrew, sorry, just quickly, I know you want to move on. Vivid Wireless, that you were talking about with WiMAX in Perth, is owned by Seven Network, according to the article I'm reading here.
That would be right. Did they keep that, did they?
They must
I thought
have.
They got into the concrete business instead.
Who's no. Seven?
No, yeah, Kerry Stokes TV. when he bought. No, no, oh, recently he bought some.
Yeah, that's right.
He bought the Flintstones gravel pit somewhere.
Mining company.
Yeah.
Bedrock.
Bedrock, that's the one. All right, in other interesting news, Google is reported to be almost ready to start using a new high-speed internet cable under the Pacific Ocean to increase its capacity by around 20%. So you can imagine that the Japanese people would consume a lot of broadband. So as a result, some new cable to go between the US and the Japanese mainland would be very good. The new cable dubbed Unity will give Google a direct connection to the Asian market from the US to potentially handle 7.68 terabits per second.
Now, do you remember Hungry Beast a couple of weeks ago talking about Google owning infrastructure?
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, this is the bit. This is the command and conquer, isn't it?
Mm.
Anyway, they're 7.68 terabits and offer Asian internet users faster browsing speeds. The project was funded to the tune of $300 million US by Google and a consortium of six Asian telecommunications firms known as the Unity Consortium. There you go. If you're listening to us in Japan, get ready. You'll get faster broadband. But I reckon they'd have pretty damn fast broadband anyway in a country like that.
They've got very good...
very dense population.
That's the thing, Andrew. That's why they've got fast broadband. They've got high availability of broadband. It's because of the population density.
They're all close to
it. It's a lower, much, much, much lower cost per head to deploy their broadband compared with here.
Yeah.
Hence WiMAX in Western Australia.
Maybe, yeah.
Mm. Well, that could be, yeah. Thinking about it, well done. JD, that's probably good. Now, Google, I think you covered this in the news, rumoured to be leaving China in April next year. What did you say, Dr. Ron? They didn't renew their was it the carrier thing?
What we would call an ISP, maybe. In China, they call an internet content provider or an ICP. And they have to be licensed by the Chinese government to be an ICP. And they missed a deadline to re-register with the Chinese government.
Did they? Intentionally, no doubt.
Well, Google spokesperson said, let's not speculate about such things. It's a bit early to be picking us up on that yet. But the industry insiders have said, no, it's a pretty clear indication that they're not going to be continuing their business there for long. They also said, or confirmed, in fact, that they've entered into negotiations with a number of very, very high-level advertising agencies in terms of reimbursing them for business loss in terms of advertising that they're going to miss out on. They've obviously entered into contracts with these advertising agencies, and now they're saying they're going to pull out, they're going to shut down Google.cn, and these advertising agencies have said, well, what are you going to do for us in terms of compensation? So Google confirmed that they're talking to several advertising agencies about that.
It's what they call make goods in the industry.
Make goods, that's what it is. Yeah.
Yep. Well, that's a valid point, actually. But then again, Google is probably one of the most wealthiest companies in the planet. They earn probably Australia's GDP in one day, according to rumours. So I'm sure they can come up with some form of deal for these guys.
We've turned off the censorship of their search engine. The Chinese government on the offensive has warned all of Google's partners, advertising partners, you must comply with censorship laws. Even if Google thinks it doesn't have to, you're still responsible. And the Chinese government called Google irresponsible last week.
Very good.
There's a bit of angst there.
Bitter and twisted too comes to mind. So, now I'd like to cast your mind back to Tech Talk Radio in 2006, where I think you, Dr. Ron, used the word sex on air.
Did I?
Yep, sex.com. And it was sold for some incredibly large amount of money at the time.
I think I used an adjective like salacious.
That's right, you did too.
Yeah.
It's all coming back to me
adjective
now.
Without notice.
Well, sex.com has gone from incredibly popular to...
It only got sold for the cost of our proposed NBN, didn't it? It was like $43 billion or something.
Yeah, not a bad domain name, really, when you think about it. Top dollar. Well, anyway, it hasn't done very well because the auction of sex.com, one of the world's most expensive domain names, has been stalled by bankruptcy issues. They've gone belly up.
Whoops.
Creditors of the owner of sex.com website have filed an involuntary bankruptcy petition against the company, stalling a lender foreclosure auction for the valuable website that was scheduled to begin the other day. So sex.com has gone down, so to speak.
So,
belly down something. I'll stop now before I get into more trouble.
I think you should. So is the domain name up for grabs?
I don't know. They didn't say that, but I suspect it's owned by the company, they'll probably flog it and try and recoup some of their losses and distribute the wealth back amongst creditors. If common business law has anything to do with what they want. But, yeah, the creditors, which are Washington Technological Associates, i.e. Entertainment and Accounting Matters.com, said they believe the auction would have diminished the value of ESCOM's assets in a statement released by their attorney. So I suspect they're trying to recoup their losses. They might sell it. So if you're interested, jump online. You might put in a bid. Put in a bid. Could be interesting. Other interesting news this week, a British hospital to treat internet addict teens. Now, to say this isn't true, British teenagers who cannot tear themselves away from the internet, computer games, or their mobile phones can get help from a new addiction service. I don't know. You'd probably have to log on for it, wouldn't you?
Connect online. I think that's the whole point. I think you don't log on to it. I think it's something that happens in real life.
You're meant to unplug and visit, aren't
you? Yes. Okay.
It's in RL, or you people on Second Life that can't unplug.
Is Second Life still going?
I don't know. I think it's... No, I think that's collapsing on itself
Lyndon,
as well.
Yeah, Lyndon Dollar.
Second Life.
You do? Hasn't Lyndon Dollar gone?
Yeah, I've been on Second Life. No, they still use it. They're not allowed to gamble in there, but they're still going quite strong. IBM have got servers in there. Telstra's got servers in there. ABC's got servers in there. Quite a lot of big companies. And a friend of mine has been on Second Life since the beta. He's helped a bank over in Europe program a whole section of Second Life that's locked off from the general public, and they use it to teach kids in high school and primary school how to use money.
Oh, well, there you go.
I know that in November last year, Telstra pulled the pin. They said no.
Yeah, I thought they went. I thought the ABC went too.
It was an interesting experiment, they said, but... Virtual Sydney disappeared and the virtual tea stores.
That's good. We only need one virtual Sydney, don't we, Warlock? No, he's not going to answer that.
No.
All right. Back to the British hospital.
Scenario. The internet addiction.
Yep. Help will be offered through intensive inpatient daycare or group therapy to children as young as 12. Although it's aimed at 15 to 17 year olds, amid increasing concern about the amount of time that they spend in front of the screen. So yes, I find that's a sign of the times. Gen Ys, Gen Xs.
A 12-year-old needing therapy for.
Okay. For internet addiction.
Internet addiction.
What would they do, surf the web all night?
Well, I was going to ask that. Is it more specific about what they're doing, or is it just, say, internet addiction generally?
You probably don't want to know.
No, that doesn't go into great details, apart from the fact that it's mental health services that they're talking about.
So it could be anything and everything. It could be Warcraft, could be gaming, Second Life stuff, could be internet messaging, it could be...
But you've got to bear in mind, too, that if a lot of kids spend a lot of time online, then they're losing one of the biggest things, which is how to communicate face-to-face, which is, you know, being socially accepted. To sit in front of a group of people and talk can be quite challenging. And I remember that there was a huge problem in Japan with that same sort of scenario a few years back when all the computer games were out and the kids just played computer games all day. They lost the skill of how to communicate, how to interact with people. I guess this is a little different because chances are they're on social networking sites talking and chatting to people all around the place. But still, interaction is a fairly good skill to have, I would have thought, in today's modern world.
There's also a few Chinese people who have played online games for 72 hours and then died over in China.
Yeah, that'd do it. Wonder what online games they were playing for 72 hours. You got to go to the toilet. You got to eat. You got to sleep. There's some vital things
these people
you need to
don't,
do.
And that's problem. They don't do that. They don't eat and they don't sleep and they don't go to the toilet. They don't get up and walk around and then suddenly they just keel over.
Oh, well. All right, whilst we're in the land of Japan, Japanese scientists have built the world's fastest scanner. You know, scanning documents.
Document scanner.
Yeah. Japanese scientists have been demonstrating a scanner that uses revolutionary chip technology to scan a 200-page book in just 1 minute. Now, that's pretty impressive, isn't it?
Very impressive.
I don't know how you have to rip the book apart to scan it, because it's probably like one of those photocopying devices, but 200 pages in just 1 minute is huge. Anyway, Masatoshi Ishikawa, that was not bad, really, was it? A professor at the University of Tokyo and lab member, I'm not going to do that twice, have built the scanner using a special supervision chip that can react faster than the eye can see.
Supervision.
The chip, along with a high-definition camera, allows a book to be scanned just by flipping through the pages.
Really? I was going to say that the issue with books, of course, is flicking the pages. Yeah.
The camera shoots at 500 frames per second at 1280 by 1024 pixels and takes two images of each page, one under regular light to get the content of the book and the other under laser projecting lines on the page. Must be a bit of a light show when it scans, but that's not bad, really. You could scan a lot of documents in, 200 pages in...
So does it flip the pages for you, or do you have to do that yourself?
I don't know.
At that sort of speed, it would have to flip the pages, wouldn't it?
Especially if it's controlled, you know. Yeah, exactly. Mm. I think that. What do you reckon? What could you use that for, Dr. Ron?
I've got one thing that you could use it for, which would be perfect. I wonder if Google's aware of this technology.
I'm sure they'd be onto it.
They're wanting to put all of the books
of the entire world
that there are in the world that there ever now and ever shall be. They're going to make them available online and bugger the copyright holders and
opt out.
Yes.
No, that doesn't mean anything to Virgin, but anyway. It's over there. You can't opt out. They just opt you back in again, and you keep getting it. No, but...
If you think I jest, have a look at books.google.com, and you can see what Google is doing with the world's books.
All right. Have you got an odd spot and a gadget and a website of the week for us?
I have got everything.
All right, I better push this button then.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, proudly sponsored by D-Link, building networks for people.
Suffering suck attack. This has to be the best technology show on the internet. Tech Talk Radio.
Telstra have dropped the price of their prepaid broadband data too.
Buckle yourself in, hold on to your hemorrhoids.
Clayton Skype, the Skype you have when you're not having a Skype.
It's a real problem.
Install Fring. Fring's great, Fring.
Now, if that's not a red rag to a bull in a china shop.
If it's in the cradle and it's all plugged in, that's fine.
Because I can stick things in its bottom. Yeah, but the, it's in the cradle.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Did you say gridiron cross-country wrestling or something?
Yeah, well, I don't know what that would... Yeah.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool! This thing is amazing!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Out of my hole!
The Harmony 900 Advanced Universal Remote Control by Logitech.
Oh, careful, you'll have Adam going.
This
off you
lets
go.
People put all their home entertainment equipment behind walls or cabinet doors without losing control.
Watch the chat. Here we go.
The simple to install. It's IR Blaster, says the spiel, and mini blasters turn radio frequency signals, not infrared.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, from the Harmony remote into infrared commands your devices understand.
What frequency is it on? Near the remote control for your mobile car or something like that?
You want to hack it, don't you?
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking of... Yeah.
The full-colour tech screen displays only the controls you need so that with one touch you can enjoy your music, watch a movie or catch up on your favourite recorded shows. Has an online database of more than 5,000 brands.
Adam's reviewed it. Expensive but nice, he says.
There you go. If you own it, the Harmony 900 will control it. Uses wireless technology, not infrared, like a normal remote control. Colour touchscreen, rechargeable with base station rechargeable. Now, it's called the Harmony 900 because guess how much the recommended retail price is?
$899.95. That'll do it.
But there you go. Adam's recommendation is expensive but nice. That's our gadget of the week. Enter the Harmony 900 by Logitech.
Here it is, everybody! The world's greatest website!
Tech Talk Radio Website of the Week.
www.chatroulette.
Oh, we've had this.
Com.
Well, not this as a website, but we've spoken about it, and Graham's typing as we speak.
We've spoken about it briefly. This is
apparently it's gone off.
It has. It's a devastatingly simple concept. It's a random...
devastatingly dangerous concept.
It is. It's a random video chat website. It's taking the world by storm. It was created by 17
the bullets with a webcam.
Yeah, it's created by a 17-year-old Russian programmer, Andrei Tarnovsky. It's similar to having a video chat on Skype, except you just connect with random people. If you don't like who you're talking to, you just hit a next button and you move on to a new chat partner. Now, the site is very Spartan, consists of a couple of webcam screens and a chat window. You simply hit new game to play a new game of chat roulette. Be very, very careful with kids. The traffic on site is not moderated, so probably not appropriate for children. In case you think it's just a passing...
Definitely not
appropriate. Don't go there.
In case you think it's just a passing fad, online measurement company Comscore released data showing that for the US alone, chat roulette's audience increased from 109,000 unique visitors in January to nearly 1 million unique visitors in February. And in Australia, it's also escalating. Its usage, the site visitors have jumped fivefold from January 18,000 to nearly 100,000 in Feb. So be careful. Sites like chat roulette do... There are other sites like chatroulettemap.com, which actually plots where the people are when they're connected and puts little thumbnails of your webcam where you are on your location.
Oh,
so
we've
be
got
careful.
The copycat sites out already, have we?
Well, they're not copycat sites. They're sites
that's part of his
add-on
site.
Add-on sites, Graham.
Oh, yeah, so you're not entirely anonymous. Just be careful how you use it and when you use it.
Strangely enough, I just hit new game and it wouldn't let me because I'm currently podcasting for the show.
Oh, there you go. Look there. It's a bit of fun, though. That's our website, Andrew, chatroulette.com.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Missed by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Don't ask! For God's sakes, don't ask!
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
This week's Odd Spot, Andrew, police in Kennewick in Washington.
Kennewick.
Have arrested a 17-year-old burglar who broke into a furniture store. The offender was identified after spending 5 hours on a store computer during the break-in, updating his MySpace.
He spent 5 hours in the store he broke into.
Browsing porn sites and then also trying to sell stolen items online.
Well, he hadn't quite stolen them yet, had he?
Log into eBay and start your shop.
This is it. A police officer said he was inside the office building, actually logged onto the computer and went to his own MySpace page. He was fooling around on MySpace for several hours. Was pretty obvious who it was. Police say he then put items that he plans to steal from
Crooks
the furniture store
dumb,
on the website for sale. The boy was arrested a few days later. He's been charged with first degree burglary.
And stupidity, I heard.
You got nothing on me, officer.
Well, stupidity on several counts. Burglary, using MySpace while committing burglary. There's our odd spot, Andrew. That's
one of the best ones you've come up with yet. I think that's absolutely... But it's really good that we've got people out there that do things like that, because otherwise we wouldn't have so much fun with them on the radio, would we?
This is it. I couldn't get onto the young boy to see if you want to come on the program, but...
Yeah, try to do a phone interview?
Yeah.
He's probably in the Washington State Penitentiary.
Yes, they won't disclose his identity because he's a child. So
There we go. Okay, so there are things to do when you break into your local white goods shop.
Yeah, that's right. So you can just imagine if he was twittering from his phone or, breaking into... store now.
Good. Excellent. All right, that is Tech Talk Radio for this week. If you've enjoyed it in Cessnock, hello Cessnockians. Is that a word?
In Cessnock?
Isn't that up north where you were saying on 2GH?
Two GHR. Is our new station. I hope everyone up there has enjoyed the program.
And the Wee Warriors in New South Wales.
The Wee Warriors, people in Cairns, people in Brisbane, people in New Zealand. Oh, look, everyone's there.
All right, well, that's it for this week. Until the same time next week, come and join us on the chat next time if you like, chat.techtalkradio.com.au and all those sort of good things, and the forum as well, so come and see us there. And until next week, bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McCollum, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Justin Dunlop and Graham Callaghan. Expert opinion is provided by Adam Turner, and our US correspondents are Lydia Davis and Mark Diggins. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is proudly sponsored by D-Link. The show is broadcast recorded and streamed live each and every Monday night at 8pm from the studios of 3WBC in Melbourne. The crew wishes to thank all the stations around Australia that rebroadcast Tech Talk Radio each week. Tech Talk Radio is also available for syndication on your local radio station. For sponsorship and advertising inquiries, call 03 9818 2756 or visit our website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.